Well, brethren, this day we have again a privilege of convention before us. We have the scripture again fulfilled, where the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered. And they're gathered from far and near. We have quite a gathering today with our brethren from Poland still with us, our brother from France, we have brethren from Canada, and all over the United States. So this is a good day to have fellowship across the land, to share the things that we enjoy, and to be used by the Lord in feeding us. For the first hour, we have Brother Jim Haig of the Columbus, Ohio Ecclesia. And Brother Jim is going to speak to us about the subject of entering the promised land. Entering the promised land. Brother Jim.
Thank you, Brother Carl, and good morning to you, brethren. It is a great privilege to be here with you today at your meeting. Before we begin, we would like to bring to you messages of Christian love from your brethren in Columbus, Ohio, and particularly there, my wife's parents, Brother and Sister McKee, who I think many of you know. And also, we bring the love of many of the friends from Dayton and Piqua Ecclesias whom we saw yesterday. And for your information, I'm sure that not many have heard, but if you remember Brother Bill Malouk from the Piqua and Dayton area, that he finished his course on Friday and was buried yesterday. And so I thought that you might wish to know that. Entering the Promised Land. The children of Israel had a wonderful opportunity upon their departure from Egyptian bondage. They could have gone quickly and claimed the land that was promised to them and promised to their fathers, the land of Canaan. But they lost their opportunity to do so through fear and through faithlessness. And as a result, they were forced to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until all of that faithless generation had died. The new generation that then approached the land at the end of the 40 years were not so stiff-necked as their parents had been earlier, but at that time they were eager to follow the word of the Lord and to enter into the land. Joshua, who was one of only two of that older generation who was yet living, was now their leader. As he exhorted the people to possess the land promised, now notice how strong and encouraging they are in their reply. Reading from Joshua 1, 16 to 18, they answered Joshua saying, "All that thou commandest us we will do, and whithersoever thou sendest us we will go. According as we hearkened unto Moses in all things, so will we hearken unto thee. Only the Lord thy God be with thee as he was with Moses. Whoever he be that doth rebel against thy commandment will not hearken unto thy words. In all that thou commandest him, he shall be put to death. Only be strong and of a good courage." Now in the second chapter of Joshua, he sent two men to spy out Jericho, which was the first major fortress that they would encounter upon entering the land. Notice their encouraging report, once again, as contrasted with the negative report that was given by the spies 40 years earlier. Their positive statement is found in the second chapter, verse 24. "And they said unto Joshua, truly the Lord has delivered into our hands all the land, for even all the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us." Surely it was a changed people, a now faithful people who stood on the brink of claiming the land promised, that land flowing with milk and honey. Now our lesson proper on entering the land begins with the third chapter of Joshua. The mighty throng of Israel had moved now to the eastern bank of the Jordan River, there to settle momentarily in anticipation of God providing a way for them to cross over. It was the harvest time when they were there, and the Jordan was not its smaller self, as it were, which was about 90 feet, but it was flooded, and the river was quite wide, perhaps swollen as wide as 500 or more feet. Now, the river being that wide was also very swift, and so it would have been quite difficult for them to just have entered in and tried to cross that river. They had to wait for a means to get across. But because of this, the Canaanites, who were on the other side of the river, of course, were oblivious to the pending danger. Oh yes, they were aware that the Israelites were on the other side of the river, but they assumed that they were safe because the river was so wide and so fast moving that Israel would never be able to cross over and cause them problems. And that worked out to be an overruling for Israel's favor, because now, with the Canaanites being off their guard, as it were, they had not sent a force to the river to try to counter any crossing that Israel would try to make. Well, after 3 days, Joshua gave the indication to the people how God would work in this situation. He told the people that they should keep their eyes on the ark, and they should watch, for the time would be when the priests would lift it and they would carry it toward the Jordan. And when they saw the priests, then they should follow. And when the priests entered the flood, then the waters would be dried, and that the people would be able to cross easily on the dry ground. God encouraged Joshua that now through this, that he would magnify him in the eyes of the people, even as he had magnified Moses before. And this encouragement that he received from his heavenly Father, he passed along to the people by encouraging them that indeed, once they were across, that God would continue their blessing by driving out all the nations that were before them that were in the land. So indeed, the priests took up that ark, and they headed toward the Jordan with the people watching eagerly for the Lord to work. No doubt the emotions of that moment must have run high. This eager faithfulness of the people, though, was indeed quickly rewarded. For even as said, as soon as the feet of the priests touched the edge of the river, the flow of the water began to diminish. And as they progressed further into the river itself, even into the actual riverbed, the waters continued to diminish, so that when they had reached the very center, the waters had stopped flowing altogether, and the priests indeed stood upon the dry ground. Now imagine the joy and the feelings of reverential fear for God that the people must have experienced as they viewed this scene. And what a wonderful reminder it must have been to them how God is able and willing to work all things out for them, to provide for their needs and to remove all obstacles that might be in their way. And their minds must have been transported back many years, back to the Exodus from Egypt, when they were told, likewise, God worked a miracle on their behalf as they fled the land, and God caused them to cross the Red Sea. And so, as it were, this great flood of people, Israel, crossed what once was the flooded Jordan, each one on dry ground. Stones were taken from the river where the priests stood, one for each tribe, and they were subsequently removed to the western bank to Gilgal and set up as a memorial to the people to remind them of God's working in this great event. And likewise, 12 other stones were taken up and set in the river itself at the place where the priests stood with the ark. Now, when all had finally passed over, Joshua commanded that the priests should come up out of the river with the ark. And now what happened before began to be reversed. For as they began to walk toward the shore, the flow of water returned slowly. But the farther they got, the greater the flow. So that as they walked toward the shore, the water continued to increase in its volume, so that the water even kept up with the feet of the priests as they walked. And again, as they totally reached the farther side, the waters had returned back to the flood which was there before. And so truly the people learned in that day that the hand of the Lord is mighty and that he is worthy to be feared and to be praised forever. These were a great blessing, I think, these experiences for the people of Israel. And I think certainly all of us as Christians today who appreciate God's dealings with Israel can also rejoice when we review here the power and majesty that God exercised on behalf of his people. But we can be even more blessed, for we can look at these things and see in them not only natural blessings, but we can see other lessons that provide blessings for us also, for us, the church now, and even for the world of mankind. And for the remainder of the time, we'll look at just a few of those lessons. The first thing we would look at is to discuss the time of when this occurred. And there are different aspects of this time that we'll look at. First of all, there are days associated here in the opening chapters of Joshua that might give us an indication of when this occurred as far as from an antitypical standpoint. Now, the first reference that we have of days is in the first chapter, the 10th and the 11th verses. It says, "Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, Pass through the host, and command the people, saying, Prepare you victuals, for within 3 days we shall pass over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God giveth you to possess it." 3 days mentioned. In 3 days they will cross. But then we have an interlude here where the spies are sent out. And you recall the problem that they had in that they were being sought out, but that they were hidden and allowed to escape. And then they made their way back to Joshua. But we have a time mentioned here again at the end of the second chapter in the 22nd verse. It says, "They went and came unto the mountain and abode there 3 days until the pursuers were returned. And the pursuers sought them out all the way, but they found them not." And then in verse 23, "Then they returned to Joshua after they had hidden in the mountains for 3 days. So now we have another 3-day period mentioned. Now, a fourth reference to look at is the third chapter in the first verse, which is not quite so clear in its statement. It says, "Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and they lodged there before they passed over." Now, it doesn't say how long they lodged there. The thought might be that they lodged there perhaps overnight. The thought in the word there of lodging may have that sentiment in it. At most, they could have only been there probably a day at this time in this verse, although perhaps it was really only less than that amount of time. Now, one more reference to look at, and then we'll try to put them together, and that's the second verse of the third chapter. Here's where they are now lodging. And then it says, "It came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host, and then they commanded the people and gave them the information concerning the ark," and so on. So really, how many days do we have? We had three, we had three, we had maybe one, and we had three. But I feel that we really aren't talking about necessarily 10 days, that actually we're probably talking about less. And there's really perhaps two ways that we might look at this. The first way I'll look at it is to say that the first reference in chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, that 3 days is a period that stands by itself as 3 days. And that it is the same 3 days that occur when the spies come back having hid in the mountains for 3 days. And so that when Joshua tells the people that within 3 days we will begin our move, that's the same time that he sent out the spies. And that at the end of those 3 days, they had returned, gave their report, and they rose up and they went to the edge of the Jordan in preparation of crossing. Then, whether they stayed there a full day or really, we think, probably only a part of a day or perhaps overnight, then 3 days more passed in chapter 3-2, and then began the actual crossing of the river. And so what I think would be a fair understanding of this is that they actually had crossed after at least 6 full days had passed, which means that they were actually in the 7th day. And we think that that is meaningful because as we look at this anatypically, it seems to imply a crossing into the anatypical Canaan of promise into the kingdom on the 7th day, the millennial age. Now perhaps we don't care to look at the days exactly that way. Perhaps all 3 days or all 3 times that the 3 days are mentioned are really the same event after all. It doesn't seem likely in my mind that may be the case, but perhaps some may view that it's really only 1 3-day period. So it's in the 3rd day that they begin their crossing of the river into the land. But that really doesn't take away much from the lesson because we know from other scriptures that when we talk about the 3rd day, that usually the implication is the 3rd day from Christ, and he was on the 5th, and so in the 3rd day, we're still back to the 7th day. And so we think that no matter how we view this, that it's pointing out to us that this is a millennial age picture that we're looking at, a time of deliverance, a crossing into antitypical Canaan, if you will. Now, another thing that should be noticed that's important that would, I think, set the time for us is the 3rd chapter and the 15th verse. And it says, as they that bear the ark were come into Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for the Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of the harvest. Then the water stopped. But that's not the important part. The important part is that little parenthetical phrase there that the Jordan was overflowed because it was the time of the harvest. Now, if we're looking at an antitypical fulfillment, this would seem to be pointing us specifically to the antitypical harvest. And so we begin to see again timing features of this antitypically. It's the end of the gospel age. The harvest is the end of the age. But what was the other picture? The other picture was that it was the 7th day. That's the millennial age. Do we have a conflict? And I think that, no, we don't have a conflict. I think that this is showing us 2 very important things. It's showing us, first of all, that the deliverance, which really is a progressive thing at the beginning of the age and really lasts all through it in one sense, is now in progress. And it begins with the house of God, which we will see will fit the picture, that the church is first delivered and then subsequently the rest. But more importantly, if this scene occurs in the millennial age, but if this scene occurs in the harvest, which is the end of the gospel age, I think it proves to us that the ages overlap, that the work of the one ends even as the other has already begun, and that they don't just stop-start, but that they merge together, even as the chart would show it with the various endings and beginnings of the ages as the gospel ends and the millennial age begins. And so we think here in this picture that we have a typical picture of, you, if you will, of the overlapping of the ages. Now another feature for timing would be found in the 4th chapter on the 19th verse, it reads, "The people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and encamped at Gilgal in the east border of Jericho." The 10th day of the first month of Nisan, or Abib if you prefer. Now, this is 40 years after the Exodus. But it's interesting to note that it's not 40 years after they left Egypt. But it is 40 years after they chose the Passover lamb. For you remember back to Exodus 12 that it was on the 10th day of the month that we just read that they took the lamb for them, a lamb for a family, and they kept that lamb for 4 days. So we wonder why they crossed the river on the 10th day and why it was. It seems like it would be so logical to relate it back and have them cross back on the 15th day. But perhaps there's a lesson for that. We can compare some of the things that happened back in Exodus 12, and we can compare some of the things that happened here, and perhaps it's pointing a lesson out to us. In the 12th chapter of Exodus, there are some days mentioned that I think we're all familiar with. As we mentioned, in the third verse, we have the lamb chosen on the 10th day of the month. And then in the sixth verse, we have the lamb sacrificed on the 14th day of the month, the slaying of the Passover lamb. Now, they slayed that lamb, they ate it, and then the next morning they left Egypt. Numbers 33:3, we have to jump up to there, tells us that they left on the 15th. So what happened? If they left on the 15th, they were still in Egypt on the 15th, and so by the 16th, they were free from their bondage, even though they still had another experience to come at the crossing of the sea. By the 16th day, they were totally free from Egyptian domination. Now, back in Joshua, we find that after they had crossed the river, which they did so on the 10th, then we find that later on in the 5th chapter, in the 10th verse, that they kept the Passover on the 14th, 4 days later. On the 15th, they ate the old corn of the land, and really it was an unleavened bread, as it were. And then on the morrow after the Passover, which would be the morrow after the 15th, the 16th, the manna ceased. And the manna ceased because they were no longer in the wilderness. They had been delivered. And so on the 16th, they were free from the wilderness wanderings, and they were free from, as it were, that special condemnation that God had put on them for their unfaithfulness in the wilderness. So perhaps, I don't know if that's a really tight tie together or not, but it's interesting, and it seems to perhaps give some reason for why they left Egypt on the 15th, and why they crossed Jordan on the 10th. One other thing that I'll just mention, and I'll just mention it casually because I really don't know the answer, and I would venture a guess there are some here that probably do, and you can tell me after the meeting what the answer is. But this is not really a time thing necessarily, but it's found in the 3rd chapter, verse 4. And it says that when the priests carried the ark into the river, and then the people were to follow, it said, "There shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure, and come not near unto it, that ye may know the way by which you must go. For ye have not passed this way hereto before." So why is it that they had to stay 2,000 cubits away? Well, there were certain practical reasons, of course. But why? I don't know. But there might be an interesting thought. This is a deliverance picture, as we begin to see. What if we try to take cubits and apply certain measurement rules to it? Well, we can get all kinds of things, and it depends on whose cubit you want to use. What seemed to work out very interestingly was using the 25-inch cubit, which is related to the pyramid cubit. 25 inches per cubit at 2,000 gives you 50,000. And consequently, perhaps a lesson is that when God began to deliver men, let's see, how can we say this so it sounds appropriate, that when God began the plan that ultimately would end in the deliverance of man, when he started working with the earth, even on the first creative day, that he knew it would be 50,000 years before men would fully be delivered and be recognized again at his divine presence, the ark representing the presence. And yet it's not after 50,000 years necessarily that this deliverance occurs, but in or during the 50,000th year when the kingdom is restored unto the Father and all things are made perfect and right. And the 50,000th year, as it will, doesn't really end, because then we enter into the ages without end, as it says in Ephesians. So that's a thought. I'm not so sure if that's the right one, but it's something to think about. Now we'll leave the some of those time features and go on to some other things. There's a general picture here of deliverance, if you will, that we can relate particularly to the church, and we'll mention it briefly. We can see in this picture that Joshua, who was the leader, would represent our leader, namely Jesus. And those that follow over and cross the river with him would represent his followers, the church. And consequently, then Jordan, which they crossed, would represent their death in consecration, dying with him, crossing over into the other side as new creatures in Christ Jesus, where they fight. As the Israelites had to fight the people of the land, so we have to fight the things of the flesh, the old nature, all those things that do so easily beset us, so that ultimately we will be found worthy of being associated with him. And of course, it's appropriate that this fighting occur. We say, well, why don't they just move in and there's plenty of room and everyone can have all their space? Why do we have to drive out the people? Well, I think you can see, obviously, that if there was a mixing between God's arrangement and, as it were, Satan's arrangement, there'd be great injury. If we allowed ourselves to be associated with sin, there would be great injury to us. We would certainly have a very difficult time making our calling and election sure. And so it's appropriate that we spend the time driving out the things of the flesh, the things of sin that do so easily beset us, and conquer the land and be found faithful. But there's another broader picture that we recognize in this too, and I prefer this picture as the primary one. The other one I like to look at as a secondary one. That is my preference in it. And this broader picture would be similar. Jordan here would represent death, and particularly Adamic death. The name Jordan means judged down, and we realize that it flows down, 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 down over a long period, finally winding up in the Dead Sea, the lowest place on earth. And so it is a good picture of death. And it seems to be saying that for 6,000 years, death kept the human race away from the blessings that God ultimately had in store for them. They were on the east side of the river. They couldn't cross until it was time for God to give them the blessing. Now, Canaan would be the place where they get life. where they pass and leave death behind them. That's the millennial kingdom. The ark that was carried into the river would represent the presence of God Himself and His grace, His goodness, His promises on behalf of all the people. The fact that He has provided a way that will cancel Adamic death and provide a means for the life blessings to be flowed to the people. The priests who carry that ark would represent the complete church, head and body. Now, notice, of course, as we alluded to a little earlier, when we say that the church gets blessed first, of course, and judged first, that indeed the priests, as it were, cross over first. Now, you might say, well, they didn't really make it all the way over, but that doesn't seem to matter. They crossed in first. They entered into the straits of Adamic death and consequently became the firstborn ones. And this was significant here that the priests carried the ark, because normally the Levites carried the ark and the priests didn't. But here the priests did. And it seems to be only for the purpose of showing us that we participate, first of all, in the deliverance of the world of mankind. None of Israel would have ever made it across that river if the priests hadn't walked in with that ark and dried up the waters. So we participate in the blessings that are going to flow to the world of mankind. And also, we're the first to be passed over. We're the first born from the dead. And interestingly enough, if we look at the picture too, what part of the priests was it that caused the water to dry up, as it were? Well, it was when their feet were set down at the edge of the water, then it dried. And as the feet continued into the water, it dried. As though to say that it's really at the end of the age, when the feet members of Christ are here on the earth, that this blessing is due to be poured out. Now, when the water dried, it would signify that there was an end of Adamic death and that now men could cross into the newness of life that was to be theirs in the kingdom blessings. But of course the water came back. But we don't believe that that pictures a return of Adamic death, but it does signify a return of death for any in the kingdom who reject the opportunities of blessings, who refuse to enter into the arrangement of the kingdom, who through faithlessness or pride or some other thing hold back, will be caught up in the returning waters of the second death. Now, there were these stones, as we said, the 12 stones that were taken out, and probably 12 stones put back in. Some of the translations are a little shakier on the putting of the stones in and seem to imply that it didn't happen, it's really only the taking out. I think it really may have happened both ways. It's a little unclear, but I think that there's a lesson both ways. The 12 stones would be, of course, one for each tribe of Israel, but antitypically we can see the antitypical tribes of Israel, and we can see pictured here, as we said, the church, the priests representing the church. Now, to take a stone in and put it there in their place would seem to show that truly for a blessing to occur, the priests had to die, just as we have to die. Jesus had to die, and we have to lay down our lives and die also on behalf of the world. But he couldn't let the priests die in the water. They had to get back out, really. And so they took 12 stones and put in where they stood to represent them so that they could stay in the water dead, as it were, their lives a sacrifice. And yet 12 other stones were taken out, and they were placed in Gilgal, and a memorial was made, as it were, a monument. And we think that's appropriate too, because then that would picture the fact that they were indeed resurrected from the dead, and that it was a memorial of the fact that it was this class that brought this everlasting salvation unto the people. There are some other interesting correlations if we look at the crossing of Jordan, and then if we think back, as we did earlier, to the leaving of Egypt and the Red Sea. There are just a few brief things here that would help us to picture this gospel age and millennial age picture. The leaving of Egypt, the Red Sea crossing, was a time when they entered the wilderness. And we know that during the gospel age, that for much of that time, the church was in the wilderness. But at the end, when the time for Jordan is here, they leave the wilderness condition. When they crossed the Red Sea, they began a period of suffering and humiliation. But when they crossed the Jordan, it was in triumph and glory. When they crossed the Red Sea, they were free from sin's bondage, as it were. But when they crossed the Jordan, they were totally free from all bondage of the flesh and made perfect in the kingdom. Now, one last lesson that we will look at, and this is for me another one of those hard lessons, because I feel prophetically ignorant, and it's very difficult sometimes to look at some of these things and determine what might be a lesson for us. But there was something that was interesting that happened in the middle of all this that might be worth addressing. And that is that Joshua told the people that they were going to enter into the land. And he told them how that they were going to enter into the land. And then he gave them some encouragement, and he just reminded them, now God is going to drive out from the land all the people that are there. And then he gives a list. And he says, it's the Jebusites and the Amorites and the Girgashites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Hittites and the Canaanites. And so he's driving out seven groups of people. Now, of course, elsewhere we find that sometimes there are 10 groups mentioned and so on. And so this isn't maybe a complete list. So we've got to ask ourselves, well, why is it a short list? Why did he give seven specific nations? And why is it that that is the big encouragement to Israel, that when you cross over, God's going to help you drive these seven nations out? Then, of course, we have to think of it anatypically from the standpoint that we're talking about a deliverance picture and the millennial kingdom and all the blessings involved. And now, what do these nations have to do with that? And so we'll give a suggestion, and you can take the suggestion and study it out and see what you think about it. We think that, even as we said earlier, if we take the picture of this scene representing the church and their consecration, we said that when they cross the land, they have a fighting to do. They have to overcome the flesh and the weaknesses of it. But that's the same thing that will happen in the other picture. In the kingdom age, when the kingdom is ushered in and men are ushered into that arrangement, and what we call the mediatorial phase of the kingdom, when the church will be indeed ruling and reigning over the earth, things won't be easy immediately for men. They have things to overcome. They have to put aside their old weaknesses and the things of the flesh, and they have to restand. That's part of their resurrection process. They have to get back to perfection, which they don't have at the beginning of the age, but if they struggle and strive during the age and obey righteousness, they'll get it at the end and they'll be found faithful for eternity. So perhaps the strugglings that Israel went through represent the strugglings that men will have to go through to overcome in the kingdom. Now, taking that as a possibility, we can look at the nations and come up with some possible things that men have to overcome. And we'll go down the list. Jebusites. It means to be trodden down, the flesh, threshing floor. That perhaps might picture a condition of putting down or treading down others, discriminating, degrading other people, and due not to having a good love for people, but primarily due to self-pride. And so that's something that men will have to overcome. The Amorites were mountain dwellers, prominent. They dwelled in the summits, and they were said to be warlike. And that would be appropriate also, for men must put aside the weapons of war and the tendencies towards warfare. The Girgashites were those that dwelled on clayey soil. Clayey soil, if you will, is soft and it's unstable, it's not firm. And that would seem to represent the fact that men will have to overcome the condition in which they once found themselves, which was unestablished with no firm foundation. And it seems to perhaps point to the fact that they'll have to overcome many of the falsehoods that they practiced under the name of Christianity during the ages, or the gospel age, we should say, particularly. The Perizzites were dwellers in unwalled villages. Now, this would seem to point out an attribute that is self-reliant. We don't need walls. We're okay by ourselves. We don't need anybody else. Self-righteousness. This condition would no doubt be based upon falsehoods, misunderstandings, misinterpretations of the real need of the people, and of course of God's workings through the age. And so self-reliance and self-righteousness in men will have to be overcome. The Hivites, that's one of the worst ones because it's hard to decide what that really is. The only definition for it is primarily merely a villager. And it's hard to decide what a villager by in and of itself might mean. So he took it and tried to trace it back, and where did the word come from? And you can trace it back from villager to a living place, to a life giver, to Eve. So the word goes all the way back to Eve. And so possibly this represents a class who make a decision to have a desire, as it were, for self-advancement and growth, and yet out of harmony with God's arrangements. Not fully self-righteous and prideful, as it were, and yet not in harmony with God. Good people. Also, there were the Hittites. The Hittites were the children of Heth, the terrible one. They would seem to be the children of Satan, the terrible one. Those who are evildoers, promoters of violence. Terrorists would be good examples today. And then the Canaanites. One thought would be the peddlers and merchants for their name. And that might be those that promote that which is false unto others. Those that promote deception and error for their self-gain. There are merchants mentioned in Revelation 18 who cry when Babylon is destroyed. That might be a picture. And then it's those that also, the thought might be dwellers in the lowlands or those that are stooped down and those that are stooped under the curse. And so broadly, of course, the Canaanites are sometimes used for the whole group of people and they're all under the curse. And so broadly, they all must overcome it. So this might be the thought of that picture, that there are those things that men must overcome. And it might be supported, and we'll throw this out as a final suggestion, in Proverbs 6, 16 to 19, it says there that there are six things that the Lord doth hate, yea, seven, which are an abomination unto him, which he certainly would be interested in wiping out in the kingdom, as it were. And those six things that he hates are a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that deviseth wicked imagination, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. If we take those seven things that God hates, and if we look at the seven people that were driven out and what they mean, and some of the thinking on it. It's not easy to just tie it in very perfectly and finally, but we can tie it in, perhaps. And we can find that perhaps we can say this, that the proud look, or the Jebusites, the lying tongue, or the Hittites, hands that shed innocent blood, the Amorites, a heart with wicked imagination, the Girgashites, feet that are swift to run to mischief, the Hivites, a false witness against brethren, the Perizzites, and those that sow discord, the Canaanites. Certainly those attributes, those evil things, are despicable. God hates them. They will be driven out in the kingdom truly. And perhaps that's the picture that he meant to give to the Israelites when he said, "These seven nations I will drive out before you." And that would conclude our thoughts on the lesson. And we trust that to some degree the Lord has added his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Jim. We appreciate being taken to Pisgah's Mountain and shown the prospect ahead of us. Now it's up to each of us to go and fight to enter the Promised Land, to drive out these enemies. Brother Jim will close with prayer, and then he'll be seated for the announcements, please.
Our loving Heavenly Father, we're grateful for your blessing here this morning to us, and knowing that you've opened up the eyes of our understanding to see more of thee and thy great plan. We pray that you would assist us to more perfectly appreciate it and conform ourselves to it, living out lives of examples unto others. And forgive us where we do fall short. Overrule anything that we have said or done amiss. We ask it in Jesus' name.